Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. Happy Constitution Day. This is the beginning of Constitution Week. I hope most people are recognizing that there's something about the Constitution that we need to preserve. Now, let's look at the numbers. Let's look historically. The Constitution was signed 233 years ago, and we've been operating under the Constitution for 231 years. Now, let me be clear, because there are people out there that try to assert that the Declaration of Independence is a founding, is a document that is still tied to our government. I want to be clear. The framers never held that paradigm. It just never got there. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that they did was they used it as an epoch. It was the epoch of a beginning of a new society that was going to be built on rule of law. It was going to be built on individual liberty and individual sovereignty. And therefore, when they fought the American Revolution, when we had the first civil war against Britain, then what we ended up doing was we ended up becoming hypocrites, because there were many people that were offered, or I should say blacks, many blacks were offered their liberty if they helped fight for America in freeing ourselves from Great Britain. As a matter of fact, it was resonating in the hearts and minds of men, the Declaration of Independence, that all men were created equal. Well, shortly out the gate and during the American Revolution, they did not, because the Articles of Confederation were written and signed hastily, but they did not include sovereignty for the black slaves of America. And so what ended up happening was, it was like the unspoken thing. They said, we got to create this new government. So from the Declaration of Independence, moving into the Articles of Confederation, they quickly formed a government that ignored the Declaration of Independence. And so just to be clear, the Declaration of Independence was not a founding document. It was not a document of creating law. It was a paradigm. It was the, like I said, an epoch and a turning point. And there's too many people out there that, you know, that hold to and cling to some of the things that are, you know, they cite the Declaration of Independence, but you have to understand that the Declaration of Independence was just a turning point. It was not something that they put. Is there any clause in the Constitution that clings to the Declaration of Independence as the base document, as Article Zero? No. And as a matter of fact, what they were doing was they were trying to build upon it in a new government. So therefore, they used that as the turning point, and then it was retired in creating the Articles of Confederation. Well, after a few years of operating in what we would call freedom, I'm not going to call it freedom, but that's, you know, how most people look at it. After the Revolutionary War, or after the perceived end of the Revolutionary War, it really wasn't over. They started operating in what we would call a free state of, you know, the Articles of Confederation. Well, the fact is that the Articles of Confederation were failed because there was an inability for America, one, to pay its debt, and America was getting closer and closer to being, quote-unquote, foreclosed on, because there was a lot of debt out there that needed to be paid, and the states were not paying their way. And as a matter of fact, the states and the Confederation, the Articles of Confederation, were destined to fail. With that, there was this huge push for fixing the Articles of Confederation. And so finally, and I believe it was in 1786, where they started having these conversations. And then there was finally a meeting in Annapolis, Maryland, where the delegates that were there all agreed that they needed to assemble a convention to fix the Articles of Confederation. And so that was the intent. However, they were going to make a wholesale change in its layout and its fundamental format, because obviously there were 13 articles within the Articles of Confederation. And as I like to tell people, God took what these men did in haste in 13 articles, and he gave them 6 articles of creating a government. And the 7th article, he rested the faith, or I should say the power, and rested the sovereignty of the Constitution upon the states in the 7th article. So if you really look, I mean, the majority of everything is already done in from Articles 1 through 6, and in the 7th article is the ratification article. What does it require for full buy-in to give this Constitution force and a legal force? Because what was ended up happening was there was going to be an abandonment of the Articles of Confederation in accepting this new form of government. And it was. It was accepted. And as a matter of fact, every state became, and I think it would have been interesting had Rhode Island maintained its autonomy and never became a part of the Union, because it would have been, we would have been forced to recognize that this union was a voluntary union. It wasn't a compulsion, and it would have been interesting to see how long, you know, if Rhode Island would still be a separate state in the union or what. But it, I just like to pose concepts of what would have happened if, you know, it's just like in reading, whether it be, you know, the scriptures in the Bible or what have you, what would have happened. And so I think it would have been an interesting learning point for history and for people to understand that this was not a compulsion into, you know, the states becoming subjugated to the general government. States had all their rights. And if, as a matter of fact, in the writing of the Constitution, after, I want to say January, because in February when, or at the end of January, I think it was the beginning of February, Massachusetts ratified their Constitution. They were the first states to provide amendments and recommendations for changes to the Constitution. Samuel Adams and John Hancock did that. And then when Thomas Jefferson, because Thomas Jefferson was not on board with this new Constitution, he said there needs to be a Bill of Rights. It's got to have a Bill of Rights. And I support the Federalist arguments that we did not need a Bill of Rights, that the Bill of Rights became problematic up until the Civil War, because states were able to still pass, states were still able to pass draconian laws and still be able to suspend the liberty. It was just the federal government that was limited. And Madison said, it's hypocritical. You're going to have a federal government that's bound by the standards of a Bill of Rights, where none of the states have Bills of Rights. Are they any more oppressed? And I think when we really start looking at the Bill of Rights and its role, it did not play a significant role in American lives until the Civil War. Now, there were points in time where there were infringements, but I'm going to tell you that there were infringements by the federal government that were violating the Bill of Rights and the Constitution long before the Civil War. So we're going to get into the Constitution. I'm going to try to identify those things that stand out. Things that, you know, either they failed on or things that you need to understand in context to today. So let's start with the preamble. And I want you to understand that the preamble is nothing. This is not granting any powers. This is just a formal statement of what they are trying to do in creating this Constitution. So it grants no powers and it delegates no powers. And it says, we the people of the United States, had they originally maintained the Constitution as it was written, it would have stated, we the people of the state of Connecticut, we the people of the state of, and it was redundant, but it mentioned all 13 states going, we the people of this state, we the people of this state, we the people of this state, blah, 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 in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure, underwrite, not e-ensure, but to underwrite domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. The most important thing that you can garner from this is it is not we the people as a democracy. It was a confederation of states, 13 at the time, excuse me, and I believe had they actually had that listing of states, every time a new state would have came into the Union, they would have had to have added, you know, Kentucky, Virginia, I should say, Kentucky, Tennessee, and these other states. And we would have had all 50 states that are operating in this Union today listed at the very beginning of the preamble. So with that, we are going to get into Article 1 when we come right back after this promo. And I'm going to get rid of this frog. I'll kill the frog. We'll be right back. Thank you so much.
Are you a patriotic proprietor of a business that is looking to get exposure on a fast-growing program? How would you like to get exposure on the only program on the air that provides an actual constitutional solution to all the federal government overreach and encroachments? If you understand the importance of educating the electorate, we would love to work with you in growing your business and revenues while you support the airing of our content on this station. Your support goes to growing the reach of this show and does not pay for elaborate salaries or highfalutin lifestyles. The show is growing fast, and we're also planning on airing the content about Republic Review on a video medium soon. If you'd like to be a part of history and the growth of the most relevant and result-oriented show on the air anywhere in the world, then just email me at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can lock in exceptional pricing and great advertising opportunities.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their Constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, so I hope I killed the frog. But anyway, one of the things I didn't get into, other than the fact that we already know that it's been 233 years since the Constitution was signed and 231 years in operating, there has been a kind of a historical paradigm regarding constitutional republics that they typically last about 240 years. Well, that means we only got 7 years left either to fix this thing or to, you know, actually, you know, between now and then see its demise, because they say it's about that time. And I can't say, I can't, I can't believe and I can't say that there's not a better compelling reason why we are not working on moving Republic Review in trying to revitalize and restore our hybrid constitutional republic, because in doing so, it ensures, it guarantees, it underwrites, just like they say in the preamble, that liberty and, well, actually what they said was ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. I can't put it any better than that. And so this is why it is so important to understand, one, the Constitution, and understand Republic Review and getting back to this framework for our general government. And, you know, basically relinquishing, freeing the shackles off of the states to allow the states to do what they believe is best. So there can't be a better argument than Republic Review. Anybody that loves the Constitution, I challenge anybody, regardless of where they find, you know, where they hang their hat as quote unquote a constitutionalist, because I see all sorts of people that are claimed at, you know, because like I said, I just mentioned just recently, Publius Hudula, or yeah, I believe that's what she goes by. That's her handle. Joanne Martin, I believe, some lawyer that is, you know, really knowledgeable on the Constitution. Well, if she was so knowledgeable on the Constitution, she would probably be on board. And I've reached out to her. I've sent her emails and tried to connect with her. But there's no doubt in my mind that her connection with the John Birch Society has kept her from actually having that dialogue, because they, you can't defend an indefensible position, because clearly we're not abiding by the Constitution. You read her writing. She talks about it. She misses it all over the place because she's thinking in context to even a unconstitutional government in the founding, because hate to say it, but that's the typical paradigm of lawyers. Lawyers actually see and accept some things that are unconstitutional. So anyway, let me move on, because this is not the anti-anybody. This is trying to get, and I just want to be clear, this is the intent, is trying to get everybody to unite in restoring the Constitution. And the only mechanism to do that will be Republic Review. If not, we will fail. Because there is no effort out there to fully restore the Constitution. And there's too many that are accepting portions of unconstitutional government in the light of, well, it's better than what we've got right now. Are you kidding me? Anyway, the other thing I didn't do is, this show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. So let's get into Article 1. Article 1 is the, it's basically, it lays the framework for Congress, and it also lays out the powers delegated to Congress. But more importantly, it also lays out the negative powers placed upon the federal government as well as the state governments. So this is a lot. There's, if, to get this through one day, impossible, but we're going to try to really fly through this. The first thing that is mentioned in Article 1, Section 1, and this is all Section 1, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives. Now, I want you to understand, all legislative powers, it means the powers to create law are vested and granted into Congress, not to the president, not to the Supreme Court, or I should say, let me do this backwards, because the Supreme Court gets away with creating laws every day because people think that if the Supreme Court declares it, it's law and it's legal. That is not the Supreme Court's role and responsibility. They're to determine whether that something exists within the Constitution or not. And a great case in point, Roe v. Wade, because there's so many people that, you know, they just get fired up over this. Roe v. Wade is not law. As a matter of fact, the Supreme Court made a ruling, but what they should have stated, but at this point in time, they had already aggrandized their power where they could create law. What they should have done constitutionally and historically throughout the annals of our history as a constitutional republic, what the Supreme Court should have done was they said, we believe that there is privacy within the emanations of penumbras, and this is the Roe v. Wade decision, that there are emanations of penumbras within the Constitution, that we believe that the right to privacy should be a part of the law, and therefore we call upon Congress to actually write and or clarify, provide that clarity to the Constitution via a amendment to the Constitution. Why? Why should they have done it this way? Because when they made changes to the Electoral College, they made some minute changes to the Electoral College to clarify, you know, a better process of selecting both the president and vice president separately and casting two ballots. And we'll get into that as a part of this process over the next week or so. I'm just sharing with you and telling you that any type of change to say we believe the right to privacy is a constitutional right, then they need to amend the Constitution to do that, because clearly it's not enumerated in the Constitution. It's nowhere within the writings of the Constitution. Therefore, Congress, the Supreme Court, should have stated to Congress to go and actually add this so that it is added. Then the states would have the final state, or I should say the final say, in articulating whether privacy is to be a federally protected thing or not. And I'm going to tell you that when the federal government has put amendments out like that, like protecting child labor in 1926, the states rejected those types of assertions. And so, therefore, the constitutional process has not been followed, and it has been ignored, and the Supreme Court is the primary guilty source of actually bypassing the Constitution and actually shredding and stepping on it. The president, as of late, in the past, you know, few decades, the presidents have been creating executive orders that have, you know, stretched their boundaries and have gotten into creating laws. DACA is not a law. The presidency does not have, the executive does not have the ability to write a DACA law. Because right here, Article 1, it says all legislative powers, all creations of law powers is herein granted in Congress, period. And so there's nowhere in the Constitution, when we get to Section 2 and when we get to Section 3, try to keep note of this because I won't remember all of these things, but when we get there, you'll note that there is nowhere within those articles nor amendments to the Constitution granting the executive and the judiciary powers to create law, period. Section 2, the House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year, every 2 years, by the people of the several states, and the electors in each state shall have the qualification requisite of for electors of the utmost or of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. So this is where they get into the qualifications for representatives and electors. So in other words, electors are to be elected based on a 2-year cycle. And so are the qualifications. Let me, representatives, 2-year cycle, and they talk about the electors, and they say the electors shall have the requisite qualifications as the representatives. No person shall be a representative who shall not have attained to the age of 25 years. So in other words, here's a basic requirement for an elector. You have to be at least 25 years old and been 7 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of a state in which he shall, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state in which he shall be chosen. In other words, who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant. What they're actually telling you is you have to be an inhabitant of the state that you are elected in. In other words, you have to be living there to be an elector and or a representative. Then the next one basically says this: representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding the whole number of free persons, including those bound in the terms of service. So we're hitting a hard break, so we're going to repeat this when we come back, because obviously this talking something about slavery here and the three-fifths rule. So we'll be right back in diving into this after this break. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TALK-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so here's an interesting thing, because this leads off on representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states. Now, most people will state that the 16th Amendment provides this concept of direct taxing the people. However, it talks about that not only are the taxes, but there shall be apportioned. And so, in other words, it doesn't state that they have the ability to target one person after another. And as a matter of fact, we will read later on in Section 8 of the first article that all burdens, everything that is applied in taxation, has to be uniformly done across the United States. This concept of having different tax brackets for people who make different income is not within the boundaries of the Constitution. However, the Supreme Court has withheld those paradigms of law because the Supreme Court has basically been able to rubber stamp changes to the Constitution, or I should say proposed changes to the Constitution unconstitutionally. Therefore, we have these different tax brackets where there is no evidence within the Constitution that the people ever allowed that type of change to where some people could be punished in the taxation process and other people that couldn't be. Anyway, because, and as a matter of fact, Wilson was very clear that he wanted to spend and spend and spend. And so his intent in the 16th Amendment was to bring in more money to pay for his unconstitutional spending. And so what they did was they basically allowed the ability to tax directly. If you go read the 16th Amendment, nowhere does it say that they will be able to break away from a uniform apportionment of taxes that is to be directly applied to the people. It's just that they all have, they have the ability to tax us directly, but they can't punish certain people over other people and or not or create people that pay or have zero tax liability. Everybody is to pay their fair share. And that fair share is based not on how much you make, but, you know, between you in the state of Louisiana and you in the state of North Dakota and you in the state of California. Everybody is to pay a uniform tax. That's all. There's nowhere where the states have granted and delegated to the federal government the paradigm of what do they call that? Progressive taxation. Anyway. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. And so this was modified by the 16th Amendment. The actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years. And see, I'm not going to get into the argument over the 3/5. If anybody wants to really dive into what were they talking about and why did they create this 3/5 rule for slaves, go read the notes that Madison wrote down on the Constitutional Convention. They get right into this because the Southern states wanted full apportionment because this way they would have been able to protect their institution of slavery. But by ratcheting it down to 3/5, the North actually calculated that over time, because of the vastness of the plantations and so forth, they would never obtain the population necessary. And they saw that the industrial states in the North would actually be able to outrepresent the Southern states and be able to do away with it. And so that was a brilliant idea until Monroe allowed the Missouri Compromise, which basically ingrained slavery into the growth of the United States, which was all unconstitutional. But I digress. Okay, so the actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States and within every subsequent term of 10 years in such manner as they shall direct, as shall by law direct. So in other words, they're supposed to have a consensus. And that's what we do is we have a census that happens every 10 years. The number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000. In other words, we're not supposed to have a representative for one representative for 31,000. We're supposed to have a representative that's not to exceed 30,000. So if you look at the numbers, we are underrepresented in Congress, in the House of Representatives. Moving on, it says, but each state shall have at least one representative, and until such enumeration shall be made, the state of New Hampshire shall be entitled to choose 3, Massachusetts 8. So they basically took the numbers that they had at that point in time, and they allocated how many representatives would be representing each of the states in the very first Congress. the next paragraph, when vacancies happen in the representation from any state, the executive authority thereof shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies. The House of Representatives shall choose their speaker and other officers and shall have the sole power of impeachment. Now, let me go back to this vacancies of happening in the House of Representatives. The executive can temporarily send a replacement until that election occurs. And that replacement is to be seated as a representative of the people. And so that process is done, you know, kind of quickly. And that way it gives the state time to allow for a fair election to occur without losing the representation necessary for that congressional district in the House of Representatives. Section 3, the Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, chosen by the legislature thereof. Now, that was modified by the 17th Amendment, for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. Well, that's kind of stating the obvious, because each representative shall have one vote as well. Anyway, but that's within their body of the Senate. Immediately after they shall be assembled in consequence of the first election, they shall be divided as equally as may be into three classes. The seats of the senators of the first class shall be vacated at the expiration of the second year. This is strictly speaking to that very first year, so that they don't have a wholesale every 6 years, a potential of losing their continuity in wiping out everybody that's in the Senate and putting new people in. So what they did was every 2 years, one third of the Senate is up for election. And so the first third in 2 years was to be reelected. The second class after 4 years, and the third class after 5th year or 6 years, so that all, so in other words, they needed to identify in Congress which ones were going to be the ones, and they wanted to make sure that both senators in each state were not in the same class. So there was a little bit of number crunching and playing and eeny, meeny, miny, mo type of stuff. But that way they actually kind of protected the Senate and its continuity. And if vacancies happen by resignation or otherwise during the process of the legislature of any state, the executive thereof may make temporary appointments until the meeting of the legislature shall then fulfill such vacancies. Again, that was modified by the 17th Amendment, but still, the state executive, the governor, has the ability, and within every state, folks, you're going to, if you go look at your state laws, every state basically allocates to the party of that congressional district the ability to determine who is going to replace that person that either died or resigned or was, you know, kicked out and or was identified as a treasonous, you know, bastard, what have you. Bottom line, this executive basically replaces each of these positions within Congress, in the House and in the Senate, until a fair election can be held to actually do a permanent replacement of such person. In each state, the parties that are part of that congressional district, and in some, it's multiple counties that actually have to meet, and then they vote in making recommendations, because this is how it's done in most all states. They'll recommend one, two, or three people to the governor, and then the governor will choose out of those three. In some states, the governor does not have to take into consideration, but 9 times out of 10, the governor will always do that. But in some states, they actually allow the governor latitude to go against that party, and so, or what the party was recommending. Anyway, moving on, here's the qualifications. No person shall be a senator. We're still going through the Senate in, what is this, Section 3. So we're still going through the Senate, and we'll be right back with the qualifications after this break. So please stay tuned. as we go through the Constitution and explain this in better light for you. So please stay tuned. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so let me be clear. If there are things, what I want to do, and if I don't do it and I skim over something and you really don't understand why they did this, what I would recommend is going through Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. And if you don't know where they are, send me an email, info@, and I will send you to the full listing of Madison's documents. As a matter of fact, you can get his book that was published, the PDF file, or you can actually just get his notes as it was extrapolated on the Avalon Project. But anyway, going through the qualifications, and some of these things are kind of interesting, like the 3/5 and that type of stuff. And I'm not going to get into that. What I want to really do more than anything else is focus on the relevant parts of the Constitution as we are seeing our government today with states violating the Constitution and so forth. So anyway, no person shall be senator who shall have attained the age of 35 years and been nine years a citizen of the United States, who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state for which he shall be chosen. Now, don't read into that. What this means is you have to be a resident of the state that you have been elected in before you are elected. And it's the same thing with the House of Representatives. One of the things I do not like is that states only require a one-year residency. I love the fact that Wyoming has, I think, a five-year residency before you can even run for governor. States should have additional constraints to ensure that there are a number of years required before somebody can go represent you in the Senate. Unlike, you know, what happened in, let's say, New York, where the Clintons, as soon as they got out of office, Hillary ran up, became senator, so that she could then, you know, create attention for her to have a presidential run. And she ran several times and she lost each time. Ultimately, she lost as the nominee. But anyway, the Vice President of the United States shall be the President of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided. The Senate will always have an equal number of senators because there's two for each state. The Senate shall choose their officers and also a president pro tempore in the absence of the vice president or when he shall exercise the office of the president of the United States and can't be the president of the Senate at that time. The Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. In other words, the House of Representatives, because they didn't even mention that yet, but they've already put up this is the first time they've mentioned impeachments. And the Senate shall have all the power to try impeachments. When sitting for that purpose, they shall be on oath or affirmation when the President of the United States is tried. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court shall preside, and no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of two-thirds of the members present. In other words, to get a conviction of impeaching. And you've got to understand, impeachment is not a criminal proceeding. This is a process of removing the president, or potentially removing the president, because once the Senate has decided that the president should be impeached, it is up to the Senate to determine what punishment that would be, whether he be fully removed, whether be he censured, whether, you know, he, you know, be publicly keel hauled or what have you. And so judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than the removal from office. So you got to understand that it cannot go beyond just the removal of office, and the intent is to remove the emoluments, the pay and benefits that the president is receiving at that point in time. And disqualification, so he's to be removed. In other words, the most extreme punishment is that the president is to be removed from office and disqualified to hold any and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under this United States. But the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to the law. In other words, the impeachment process is not a legal formal punishment. It is saying, hey, you are now disqualified. We're removing you, and you're not getting, you know, you're not going to go and collecting $200. Well, so just to understand what has happened, the president, when he left office at the signing of the Constitution, the way it was ratified, he was not to receive a retirement. He was not to receive a permanent position as a former president to be able to go and become a part of formal briefings so that he understands it, and having a security. I mean, President Washington, when he retired, people actually rode out to his estate, and he kept whoever it was that knocked on his door. He'd let them stay overnight if he possibly could. And so the paradigm of a permanent emolumentation at the time of the Constitution, in other words, pay, security, and all those things, was not in the Constitution. This is why when they started creating a lifetime emolument for the president and his spouse and family, this is why we should and now have the right to be able to impeach presidents who have been, you know, who've already left office, because the intent is to remove those protections and qualifications for being able to do anything else. And as a matter of fact, if we impeach a president, he should be ineligible to hold office or be a representative of the United States in the UN or any of these other boondoggles that they've created to water down and to actually challenge the veracity of the United States Constitution. I want you to understand, I'm going to say this one more time, that because they've made changes of permanent emoluments and permanent positions for former presidents are now susceptible to being impeached by Congress. Because even though they didn't amend it, the only reason it was applied to the present president is because when a president left office, he was no longer receiving emoluments and a permanent status. So we do have the ability to remove Obama, the Bushes, as well as Clinton and his wife and family and all of these criminals. We have a responsibility to go and impeach them and remove their security, remove the burden that they have created for us for life. Get rid of them and then basically banish them. They can't go publicly speak as a former president because that is something that's a part of that punishment. We have the right to remove them and strike them and make them disqualified to ever speak for the United States or be recognized as a official former president. We basically stripping them of all of that class that they, you know, they believe they've acquired and they believe they have right to. Anyway, Section 4. Now we're in Section 4 of Article 1. Section 4, the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. But the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations except as to the places of choosing senators. And so they do have the ability to make at any time law to make or alter such regulations, but they do not have the ability to change those things that are identified within the Constitution, such as the choosing of electors. That is a very specific process that is enumerated in the Constitution. And when we go through this, we're going to be getting into the electors as we come into this, and we won't get into it today, but we will get into the electors very soon when we get into Article 2, and we'll go into the 12th Amendment as well. And I'm going to prove to you that the process of choosing the electors, the state representatives do not have the power to dictate who will become your representative as you are supposed to vote for your congressional seat. Which means, and what I'm telling you, is this winner takes all is unconstitutional. Allowing the party to dictate who is going to represent you by a popular vote is repugnant to republicanism and our American Republican Constitution. So we will get into this. The times, places, and manner of holding elections. Okay, so I already did that. The second part of Section 4. The Congress shall assemble at least once in every year, and such meetings shall be on the first Monday in December. So in other words, when they're supposed to meet, they're supposed to meet as the beginning of their session on the first Monday of December, unless they shall by law appoint a different day. So boom, now they have the flexibility. And you will not see that language unless they appoint by law a different way of choosing the electors. In other words, the Constitution is very clear unless they've put that little caveat there that says, unless they shall by law appoint a different mechanism. Section 5. Each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members, and a majority of each shall constitute a quorum to do business. So in other words, they only need a majority to be able to actually function. Now, in the very first Congress, Madison actually waited and wanted to make sure that they had a supermajority, not just a basic majority. Anyway, what we're going to do is we're going to pick right up in Section 5 in our next episode. I'm not going to get into the perfunctories, and I've just really quickly go through the obligatories of who we're sponsored by, but we will get this through because we want to help you understand in context what the heck's going on in our republic. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.